we want to start off by asking you about your thoughts on the anti-globalization movement, which has been, in a lot of ways, one of the more significant developments in the past 10 years, we think, in terms of a global phenomenon that's seen a lot of people moving in struggle against capital and the state, and also has a very important components that are led by indigenous peoples throughout the world and engaged in struggles which, as we've seen in the recent case of Bolivia and even Argentina, have led to the toppling of governments and the posing of a question of some kind of a different world order.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, what's your take on this movement? It's been criticized a lot in the U.S. context as being the sort of preserve of middle-class kids running around summit hopping. There's the activities of a more radical wing within this movement. What do you think of the anti-globalization movement?
Well, everything you just said is true. I mean, there's elements of truth to all of it, including the middle-class kids summit hopping. That said, so what? You may be speaking from a... I'm not sure exactly why you would be post-Leninist rather than non-Leninist, but in any event, last I heard, Lenin was a kind of a middle-class kid. Didn't preclude getting certain things done. Not always positive things, but then again, the history of that is he was off the table pretty quickly. So, the anti-globalization movement, for lack of a better term, is, I think, a very positive development in the sense that it sort of reinfuses the opposition with a sense of purpose, enthusiasm, vibrancy, all of that. Those factors are there. The energy's up. Downside of it is it's a contra-analytical movement in the sense that it thinks it's something new. It's sort of like the reinvention of a wheel, you know. We used to call this anti-imperialism, okay, just straight up. It's not contentually especially different from that, although it doesn't understand its own history, and that's always a dangerous circumstance. The idea that couples to that is that globalization is somehow something new rather than a continuation of dynamics that are at least 500 years deep historically, and that needs to be understood. You got to know your adversary, your opponent, the phenomena you're up against if you're going to be able to deal with it constructively. And I don't see much of that. You know, this sort of state corporate interlock in coordinated fashion to project power and coordinate markets and all the rest of that. My God, how far do we have to go from this hotel to arrive at the bay? And the bay is exactly the Hudson Bay Company. And what is that? It's a Crown Charter Corporation. And what is that aside from the direct interface between state and corporation? And that's a few centuries old even here in Canada. You want to look at the East India Company? You want to look at the Plymouth Charter Company? I mean, the moment the Portuguese tried to circumvent Africa to get around the Islamic barrier so that they could have access to resources and markets in the East, ending up on the west coast of Africa and opening up as a result of that what becomes the transatlantic slave trade, you could date the origin of globalization right from there. And actually, I would argue you could date it even earlier. So, know your enemy. Know your history. If you don't know your history, you don't know your present. If you don't know your present, you can't possibly project future in any coherent way. So there it is.
And I guess that's the issue for the movement at this stage is projecting what kind of a future, and what is possible.
Yeah.
And there's the sort of do you have any thoughts on the Porto Alegre Forum, or is there indeed a new way that's being put forward that is not rewarmed social democracy, or that is not some kind of accommodation with a system? Like, what kind of world do you think we should be looking towards?
Well, there are at least elements of something, if not new, because I can make the same argument about this. It's always been there and implicit, hasn't been recognized for what it is, and therefore has not been acted upon. The idea of incorporating directly content of indigenous worldview into the counter models that are being at least incipiently poised, that's new in the sense you've got a cognition on a much broader sector of the movement, real or potential, of what that could mean than there has ever been in the past. I mean, if you look at the last wave, if you will, again, for lack of a better, a more accurate way of putting it, which would be the anti-colonial movements of the 1940s through 80s. Take Nkrumahism as a sort of a benchmark. I mean, it posited not imperialism, but tribalism as the primary thing to be overcome. Well, if you are an indigenous person, that's just the flip side of the same coin of your oppression. So you're changing oppressors. You're not actually fundamentally reorganizing or reordering either consciousness or the structural reality of oppression in such a way as to provide even the basis for a potential positive realization in the future, near term or long. This is a bit different. I would argue a bit more coherent, at least in its potential. I keep talking about potentials because we have anything but a realized situation on our hands. The possibilities now exist for a better, more constructive articulation of alternatives that existed in the past. And this is not to diss in any way the anti-colonial movements of the past two generations. I mean, they are absolutely necessary, vital. Everything else, all the other affirmative adjectives you could attach to that, in laying groundwork of consciousness and laying a, if you will, again, structural basis for continuation, a counter to the continuation of the imperial dynamic, has to be matched by a continuation or development of base and consciousness for anti-colonial or anti-imperial dynamic, if this makes sense. I don't know. Should a gender question?
In your book, Struggle for the Land, there's an essay called I Am Indigenous.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate a bit more on the politics and pedagogy of indigenism?
I can by way of your introduction, perhaps, of yourselves. You know, you see, you're post-Leninist, fine. Whatever that means, I question that.
Referring to that as a group, as a new socialist group as a whole.
Understood it. Why are you something that goes beyond Leninism rather than something that isn't Leninism?
It's a reflection of the roots of where the genealogy of the political movement came out of.
But you culminate that with describing yourselves as revolutionaries, and I say, why? I mean, you aspire to overthrowing the presiding regime or order in the Canadian state so that you can reorganize the Canadian state in a more constructive fashion? Then you're not a revolutionary. Do you want to see the Canadian state here when you're done in some form or another?
Of course not.
Then you're a devolutionary, and you might want to call it by its right name. I mean, you're continuing linguistically a heritage that results in what I just put forth as being a kind of a mirror image of the order you oppose.
So would you say that no anarchists could call themselves revolutionary? Because anarchists...
I think that if they do, they're deluding themselves. Okay, they're not understanding themselves or the tradition that they're espousing in proper terms, because for starters... anarchists are explicitly anti-statist, okay? And the object of a revolutionary is to change the regime of power in a given state's structure. So I think revolutionary is a misnomer.
Yeah. Well, I think that the perspective that we'd be articulating is not, I mean, is the total destruction of states in general and all states, or, I mean, the Canadian state in particular and all states in general, but the replacement of that by... You know, by genuinely democratic, popular councils, neighborhoods, self-organized. Basically, talking about self-organization and self-emancipation and the development of a revolutionary society, and with the understanding that this is occurring within a colonial or neo-colonial context in Canada, based upon stolen land.
Yeah,
so
agree.
we would share that. The only reason that I referred to, I mean, it's a bit of a shorthand to refer to the New Socialist Group as a post-Leninist group. But in the sense that many of its members came from a tradition that, ascribed to Leninism. Myself would describe myself as an anarchist communist, and as somebody who's definitely left that behind. But I mean, like one of the issues with devolution, or even the terminology of devolution, and even what you were saying with Nkrumah, battle against tribalism, is that how do we relate these concepts to the fact that potentially they indicate an attempt to go back to some kind of ideal way the world once was, and seem sort of ahistorical, or don't recognize that capitalism is a world system, is a totality that must be destroyed on every front, and that and that we can't sort of roll back the clock of history and have
Of course not, but that's again, we're into this implicitly Marxist progression, and anarchists aren't especially progressive. In fact, you get a physical fight from some of them for using that term because they consider it an insult. And I think properly so. There's no immutable law of history that's guiding things that it goes according to material standards in a unitary direction. I mean, you might as well be a Jesuit as to advocate that point, because it's this linearity of time that's affixed to some sort of a tangible set of indicators that you're moving along the continuum. Okay, no, of course you cannot roll back the time unless you, in Einsteinian sense, manage to exceed the speed of light in a space curve, okay, and go backwards. No one's advocating that. Okay, the structures, however, are not immutable, and they can be devolved, they can be deconstructed, to cop a term that I don't especially like because of the connotations that have been attached to it. Okay, we can go forward too. I won't argue necessarily a tribalist structure. I got problems with that term too. Tribe replaced nation in the legal discourse in the United States, for example, is a sort of demotion of standing of indigenous peoples. Okay, tribal may be a way of describing something, but it's not applicable in all contexts. Okay, and that's not what we're talking about. But we got this conflation of terms and a sort of a mental confusion that attends them by clinging to things that didn't describe in any way at all what we're after here. And one conflation that really bothers me a lot, that seems to be plaguing the discourse still, is a conflation between the term nation and the term state. You know, you have this entity out there called the United Nations. It really should have been called the United States, because to be eligible even for admission to the council, you have to be organized in that centralized, arbitrary, imposing sort of structure. No nations, as such, are even eligible for admission to the United Nations. United States was a name already taken, however, and this was very useful in obfuscating the reality. But the upshot of that is you got a whole lot of anarchists running around there thinking they're anti-nationalist, that nationality and nationalism in all forms is necessarily, okay, some sort of an evil to be combated, when that's exactly what they're trying to create, is nation. Okay, which is an affinity group. You've got 4,000 or 5,000 nations on the planet. You've got 200 states, but they're using anti-nationalist as a code term for being anti-statist. All right, with indigenous peoples, nationality is an affirmative ideal. Okay, and it's not got any similarity at all to statist structure. You may have nations that are also states, okay, but you've got most nations rejecting statism. So you could make an argument, as I have, and you actually cited one of the pieces in which I make it, that the assertion of sovereignty on part of indigenous nations is an explicitly anti-statist ideal, and the basis of commonality with people who define themselves as anarchists in this other tradition, this dominating tradition, okay, the opposition needs to understand that and embrace our nationalism in the same sense they would embrace, oh, the CMT or whoever around Barcelona. Okay? You can view the Catalans as a nation, properly understood, who are opposed to the Spanish state, who organize themselves on explicitly anarchist ideals in terms of cooperation, collaboration, way of achieving self-sufficiency, and collaboration with other nations in this entity, the statist entity known as Spain. Again, I don't know if this tracks or not, but see, we gotta deal with our own bases, the plural of confusion. Get clear, okay, in order to be able to interact with one another in a respectful and constructive way. And only in that interaction can we pool resources and create a counterforce that is equal to the task of taking a very well organized internally and very obfuscatory story externally adversary or set of adversaries that comprise this order you're defining as capital. I'm not even sure they're capitalists at this point. I think they may be a transcended capital, properly understood in some respects. I'm never sure they were. Well, you've always, capitalism being defined in classic terms as this sort of entrepreneurial free enterprise system, I can't find any evidence of it ever having existed. I mean, the whole notion of capitalism is built on the back of things like the Hudson Bay and East India corporations, which were always a state interlock with the corporate edifice, and that is usually defined by free market thinkers as evidence of a socialist content. It's perhaps a form of state socialism that's alien to classical Marxism, more akin to Italian fascism or something, but that's always been the rubric of its expansion and power consolidation and so forth. And yeah, you do have this little seedbed out there of individual entrepreneurs that contribute to the whole, but that's actually their aspiration, is to plug into this very systematized, structured, and anything but free and open core of the overall dynamic, really. It is a dynamic. It's never been static. But as capitalists, the economists, Friedman, and all those people would define capitalism, where is it? It exists in a certain strata, but that strata is not the decisive strata in determining the success of the whole project. So, I think I'll just leave it there. I will add one caveat to that. If you understand this monstrosity that has traced this trajectory as being a form of socialism, which I think it actually is, if you're defining socialism as the interaction of the state and the other vectors of economy, the production zones of it, then socialism doesn't really appeal automatically as any kind of an alternative. And that's the progressive thing too, incidentally. I mean, those who define themselves as progressives are in one or another configuration self-defining as socialists. So I kind of dropped this notion of progressivism a long time ago. That's the idea that you can continue incrementally to alter the existing structure and have it end up being, well, if not the opposite of itself, at least something that could be embraced and positive. And I don't see that. I don't see anything inherent to this system that redeems it if you develop it properly.
I think we'd agree with you 100% on that. I guess our definition of socialism would be more about the self-activity and self-organization of those oppressed by the system.
But then you're talking there something more akin to communism, which socialists don't always like either.
Yeah.
Communism is a much abused term, okay, yeah, because you never had it in the places that are usually described as being communist countries. I mean, quite the contrary.
Yeah.
It's just a different form of state socialism, all right? National socialism, Stalinist socialism, all those other socialisms, they all purported to be communist, but where was that? I mean, you can't have a centralized state structure and an arbitrary imposition of order and all the rest of that and communism at the same time. And those defining characteristics went to the functioning of the state in each instance. So, once again, got to use the terms properly and kind of redeem them and be clear among one another first. If we can't be clear among one another, we can't possibly be clear to people who aren't numbered among us right now. So we present this confusing image, and they just say, fuck you, you're a bunch of middle-class kids that want to play silly little street games wearing black uniforms so that you look like the SWAT team.
In terms of the Black Bloc, I remember reading on email, after the Seattle actions, there was a communique that was put out by the Acme Collective or something like this, and
okay,
you had some... There's a sort of debate around the whole question of diversity of tactics, which has occurred a number of different places. I think Michael Albert maybe took a different side from you. And there's this whole question around the radical wing of the anti-globalization movement that's trying to directly take on the state. Now, are they actually really doing that, or are they really? Is property destruction itself just another act of symbolic protest in itself and not actually a transformative thing? So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about if you see the Black Bloc as being at all an interesting or relevant political phenomenon, but also about the ways in which there's been a contemporary resurgence of anarchist politics, both infusing the anti-globalization movement and also being seen. There's very recently a conference, the Anarchist People of Color Conference. I don't know if you heard anything about it. But significant in the sense that there's been, I think it was one of the first, if not the first of its kind in recent North American history. And are there things, like, are there correlations between your indigenous perspective and anarchism? I'm not, you know, and there's
many people might make an argument that in fact indigenism is an ancestor to anarchism and not vice versa. But I was wondering what you had to say about that.
Well, to begin with the last part first, that is precisely my argument. Okay, the two are not interchangeable. All right. Point for point, but they have far more in common than they had dividing them if each is properly understood. And part of the task here is to make them properly understood. So I sort of went to the belly of the beast with that. I mean, aside from going to Bob Black, who I will not go with other than to flatten the motherfucker, okay, the so-called Eugene anarchists, and that's sort of pivotal in the context of Washington, or Seattle as well, okay, who are kind of emblematic of what I was talking about, of misapprehended the distinction to be drawn between nation and state, and just using this soundbite, knee-jerk vernacular of dismissal because of the nationalist content of indigenism. Now, over a four-year period of time, roughly, we've gotten completely past that. So if you look at Green Anarchy, for better or worse, you're going to find all kinds of reference to indigenous peoples and the commonalities on every basis, from social organization to environmental perspective. So I think it's really easily possible in the end. It takes some time, but you can make that particular bridge conceptually, and it's understood. So that's a philosophical attitude and relationship I would see between indigenism and anarchism. Okay. I would see the main distinction in this continent as being a detachment from base. Indigenous peoples are grounded quite literally. I mean, there's the relationship to the land, which has evolved over thousands of years and so forth, and that's completely denied to the people who are self-describing from the settler culture as being anarchists. With that distinction made, however, we got all kinds of principles in common, aspirations in common, perspectives in common, and we need to build upon those in order to develop a respectful set of relations that allow us to act in a kind of unity against that common oppressor that we share. Okay. Now, as to tactics, you ask whether I saw that as a positive development, and made mention of the fact that I quite straightforwardly defended them in the context of Seattle. Not that I think that breaking the windows on Starbucks is somehow going to bring the system crashing to its knees, or that they even had a conception of what they were actually up against, because you do know Clinton deployed Delta Force for that one in case things really did start to get serious. I mean, that's as serious as it gets in terms of repressive capacity in the United States. These are the surgical assassination units. And they were mustered for that, and they were deployed in Seattle. And I know nobody on the street knew that, but if you're going to go up against that, or if you're actually going to do serious damage to the structure of things, it isn't going to happen in some sort of a frontal confrontation with whatever force deployment the state makes. So in this sense, it is symbolic. In this sense, it is learning. And in this sense, it's kind of empowering. All right, the ability to actually engage in combat, for lack, again, of a better term, but that's what it's going to be. There's the combat dimension. It's much broader than simply the combat. But if you're going to engage that, you're not going to simply wake up one morning, take a pill along with your glass of water, and go out prepared to do it. You've got to build the consciousness. You've got to build the psychology. You've got to build the experiential base. You've got to build a theoretical base. And that happens step by step by step. Maybe the thing that happened in Seattle was in a sort of, let's get out of the chat rooms and get out of our little round table get-togethers in people's living rooms and see if we can actually make a physical confrontation. There hasn't been anything significant along that line for 25, 30 years in the States. Can we do that? Can we actually come out the other side of it stronger than we went into it? All of that was done. That's great. Now, even in the level of street confrontation, what can we adduce from that experience? Well, maybe a first lesson would be, if you actually want to engage in street confrontations as such on a further building trajectory, you want to ditch the uniforms and stop self-identifying as somebody the police want to neutralize immediately. Okay, unmask yourself, put on a phony beard, clean shave, or else shave your beard and go out for that, then regrow it afterwards, mask yourself in another way. Just this level of tactical evolution, which they refused. And this is what leads some people, or at least this is one piece of what it is that leads some people to purport this as more of a fashion statement in some respects than it is a serious political tendency. I'm not convinced of that in any way at all. But people are clinging to their signs and symbols at a very basic level in a way that precludes taking the action on further along the line of what you get these cataclysmic statements of what is necessary, and they won't even ditch a funny little signifier or their identity as a black blocker. Well, got to get past that.
Is there, okay. is there a correlation between the development of the black bloc and the taking on of these more militant tactics with a more direct confrontation with the state as, say, the people in the... Do you see any correlation between the way that the Weather Underground developed and evolved as, you know, from the days of rage in Chicago, taking the streets and sort of fighting with cops into that kind of... is there some kind of progression that occurs there? And what are the lessons to be learned from how those
there is a progression, but
the
60s. The weather, well, it was, you know, it's another thing I'll completely defend. It was the spectrum of responses mounted by the white left at the time. That was the most valid response of all, which did not mean that it actually thought it through and had a viable strategy for consummating, but the response pattern was entirely legitimate, okay? And it was really necessary for someone to make that statement. But ultimately, they get boxed into symbolic actions as well. And that's explicitly the case in this new... I know these guys. I was actually part of that at one time. But Brian Flanagan and Mark Rudd, the people who are in this new film about Weatherman are saying that. You know, we made a conscious decision to do only property actions, okay, which was not the original impulse and not the original understanding, but it was a sort of a... wounded response to leaving three whole cadres. Well, in human terms, I understand that these were their friends and all that. If you are actually serious about engaging in an armed struggle in clandestine capacity in the United States, you're going to have to anticipate you're going to incur casualties, and three is hardly an insurmountable toll that's been taken. So, again, you got middle class kids who are posturing as something else and legitimately want to be something else and are trying to transcend their origins but can't do it in and of themselves, and they didn't really have an interactive relationship with movements, organization, people coming from a different experiential background to temper their own sort of bourgeois response, which is what it was. So you're saying you're going to do one thing, but actually you're unprepared to do it. And I can understand that, but I don't accept that as being a model. So I'm more encouraged by the fact that people are looking seriously at the Black Liberation Army and such, despite, you know, the valid critique that there was a certain Stalinist content to the organization. And that raises the question of how exactly, without getting into a centrally organized, arbitrarily opposed disciplinary organization, you mount a clandestine struggle. That's a serious question. How do you go about it? It's not laissez-faire. It's not everybody do your own thing. It can't be, or you're just dead. All right. But these were organizations that were willing to sustain casualties in a serious way over a protracted period, and they were ultimately burned out because they had no basis for recruiting additional members to replace the casualties out of some broader context or mass movement context or whatever, and that's a lesson to be learned and addressed as well. But you got to go beyond weather, is the point that I'm trying to make. Weather presented a certain example, not a model. Okay, from that example, you can extrapolate to the next model, which would be, say, BLA or the Puerto Rican Independence Movement. You can not so much critique as analyze and understand where it was they went wrong and address those issues and build a more viable model now. But you can't do it off the sort of knee-jerk reaction on notions of personal purity, which is, well, that's my critique of pacifism. You're probably familiar with that, and people who'll be reading this are probably reasonably familiar with that, but that's not the only dimension that this would apply. Anarchists in general got this zealots' notion of the purity of the politic, too, which is why they've been just, without even examining the thing, the proposition in any coherent way at all, just dismissive of anybody who defines themselves as being part of a national liberation movement. Okay, when someone sits down and talks with them about it, well, their objections evaporate, okay, but they won't abandon the purity of whatever the particular posture is they're occupying long enough to become effective. And that's the problem with refusal to abandon the mask and the black t-shirts in certain contexts, too. They're more interested in making the statement or the affirmation of identity than they are in actually accomplishing the goals and objectives that supposedly attended. These are transient things, I would hope. I don't see them as being a basis to dismiss or discard the impulse at all. I see the impulse as being primarily a positive impulse and need to take it on to its more logical set of conclusions or along the line towards them. So, the black blocs, the preoccupation with anarchism, the willingness to engage, which they ultimately were, both in physical engagement with the state at a certain level and engagement in discussions to interrogate their own sets of precepts, are both really encouraging signs.